NASA is about to launch its first mission to the moon in over a decade. If all goes well, a rocket will blast off from Florida tomorrow afternoon. No humans are going up this time, but the rocket will be carrying a couple of probes that are part of NASA's effort to prepare for a future manned mission. One probe will map the moon, the other will search for water. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has that story.
Almost 40 years ago, Craig Tooley watched two men touch the moon for the very first time.
I clearly remember, you know, the Apollo 11 landing. I was a young child, but I was old enough to watch it on television and remember it.
Now, Tooley is working to find safe landing sites for the next generation of lunar explorers. He's in charge of a spacecraft called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. It will circle the moon about 31 miles above its surface and gaze down with seven science instruments to create a detailed map of the landscape. NASA already knows a fair bit about the area around the moon's equator, where the Apollo astronauts landed, but Tooley says the rest of the moon is more mysterious.
We, at the moment, have much better maps globally of the planet Mars than we do of the moon.
Tooley says on NASA's current maps, the location of some craters and mountains could be off by miles. And the maps don't have detailed information about smaller landscape features, which would make it difficult to pick a safe spot for a future moon landing.
So you wouldn't know if you were coming in or even planning a landing site if you were going to, in the end, really be landing on a boulder field with, you know, house-sized boulders or significantly sloped craters.
The Lunar Orbiter's camera system should be able to detect anything that's bigger than about a foot and a half across. It should even be able to spot some artifacts from those Apollo missions that Tooley watched as a kid.
Things like the rovers or the lower half of the lunar excursion module, and perhaps even bunches of tire tracks and such.
If NASA does send astronauts back to make new tracks, the lunar poles are appealing as a destination because scientists think they might be home to water ice. Dan Andrews works at NASA's Ames Research Center. He says water could come in handy for future astronauts.
The availability of water right there on the moon, the availability of producing oxygen, oxidizer for rocket fuel for other missions. It's very, very interesting if water ice is indeed there.
The moon's poles have cold, dark, permanently shadowed craters. Andrews says scientists have detected a curious abundance of hydrogen there that could mean water.
That is no guarantee that there's water ice there, and so there's the open question.
To try to answer that question, NASA is sending up a second probe, the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite. It will try to kick up evidence of water by basically throwing a big piece of trash into a dark crater. Andrews says the spacecraft will take the spent upper stage of its rocket and put it on a collision course with the lunar surface.
We're not shooting it into the moon. We simply let go of it, and the lunar gravity actually pulls it in.
The rocket part will smash into a crater and send up a huge plume of dust and maybe ice around 6 miles above the lunar surface. People on Earth who have a decent amateur telescope may be able to see it if they're in the right spot. NASA's observation spacecraft will get a more close-up view as it flies down through the plume, taking measurements as it goes.
We take pictures, slow-rate video data back to Earth, send it back to Earth live.
The science data has to come back live because just 4 minutes later, the spacecraft will be dead. It will slam into the crater as its partner on this moon mission, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, watches from above. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
And we have some prime news this morning. Drum roll, please. Thank you very much. A computer professional in Norway has discovered a new Mersenne Prime, what you and I might call a prime number. This discovery brings joy to prime number fans worldwide and brings a special satisfaction to NPR's Joe Pelka. He'll tell you why.
For those of you for whom basic math is a distant memory, we begin with a reminder. Primes are numbers that are divisible by only one and themselves. So 2 is prime, so is 3, 5, 7, and so on. 2003 was a prime year, so will be 2011. Mersenne primes have been called the jewels of number theory. They are a special class of prime, and they have a particular formula. I will now tell you the formula. And let me warn you, only trained professionals should attempt to give mathematical formulas over the radio. Here goes. It is 2 raised to the nth power minus 1, where n is itself a prime number, and the result is prime. Ancient Greek mathematicians were the first to describe mersenne primes. So far, only 46 have been discovered. Or now, I should say 47, because there's a new one, and it's a whopper nearly 13 million digits long. It was found as part of the Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search, or GIMPS. GIMPS involves tens of thousands of computers churning away looking for new mersenne primes. Mathematician Chris Caldwell of the University of Tennessee Martin says finding mersenne primes takes a lot of computing power.
Not only do you have to multiply a 13-million-digit number times a 13-million-digit number, you have to do that about 13 million times. That just takes a tremendous amount of computation.
When I first reported on the Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search last April 10th, I exhorted NPR listeners to download the software and join the effort. The new Mersenne Prime was discovered by someone who was already a prime hunter. Odd Magnar Strindmo from Milhus, Norway, has been part of GIMPS since it began in 1996. Now, finding a new Mersenne Prime is exciting all by itself. But it's especially exciting because of a bet I made with George Woltman. He's the man who runs the Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search. I bet the next one would be found before 2012, helped along by all those NPR listeners who I hope would download the program. Woltman emailed me saying he felt a little silly losing the bet so soon, but I have a confession to make. I meant the next largest Mersenne Prime. The 47th Mersenne Prime is actually 141,125 digits smaller than the one that was discovered last year. So I won on a technicality, and I'm willing to carry on the bet until the next largest one is found. After all, we didn't bet any money, so I can afford to be magnanimous. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Today, the White House released a report that reminds us that global warming is already affecting our weather, and it's going to get worse. The report says cutting carbon dioxide emissions is a necessary step. Meantime, the National Academy of Sciences held a meeting this week to look at some of the more far-out ideas. Those ideas focus on whether we could safely cool the planet by engineering the climate. NPR's Richard Harris went to the meeting to find out more.
It seems like science fiction, manipulating our atmosphere to counteract the effect of all the heat-trapping carbon dioxide that we're pumping into the air. That's certainly what Earth scientist Ken Caldera thought a decade ago when he first heard the subject raised in a talk by a nuclear weapons researcher.
He basically said, we don't have to bother with emissions reduction. We can just throw aerosols, little dust particles in the stratosphere, and that would cool the Earth. And I thought, oh, that'll never work.
Caldera sat down to study this and was surprised to discover, yes, it would work, for the very same reasons that big volcanoes cool the Earth when they erupt. Fine particles in the stratosphere reflect sunlight back into space. And it would be cheap to do. Caldera is at Stanford and the Carnegie Institution. He says over the past decade, talk about this idea has moved from cocktail parties to very sober meetings, like the one this week put on by the National Academy of Sciences.
Frankly, I'm a little ambivalent about all this, that I've been pushing very hard for a research program, but it's a little scary to me as it becomes more of a reality to think that we might actually start learning how to toy with our environment or our whole climate system at a planetary scale.
This raises so many questions, like when would you even consider trying it? Caldera argues we should have the technology at the ready in case there's a climate crisis, collapsing ice sheets, famine, something of that nature. At the Academy's meeting, Dan Schrag from Harvard University agreed with that, up to a point.
I think we should consider climate engineering only as an emergency response to a climate crisis. But I question whether we're already experiencing a climate crisis, whether, in fact, we're already crossed that threshold.
The reality is carbon dioxide emissions globally are on a runaway pace, despite rhetoric promising to control them. David Keith from the University of Calgary suggested we should consider moving toward experiments that would test ideas on a global scale sooner rather than later.
It's not clear that during some supposed climate emergency would be the right time to try this new and unexplored technique.
Experiments could create disasters. During a coffee break, Alan Robach at Rutgers University cataloged a long list of risks. Particles in the stratosphere that block sunlight could also damage the ozone layer, which protects us from harsh ultraviolet light.
Or that it would reduce precipitation in Asia, where it's a source for food for 2 billion people.
Imagine if we triggered a drought and famine while trying to cool the planet. On the plus side, it's also possible that diffusing sunlight could end up boosting agriculture, he said.
We need to evaluate all these different contrasting impacts to see whether it really would have an effect on food or not. Maybe it's a small effect, and we really don't know that yet. We need more research on that.
Thought experiments to date have focused primarily on the risks of putting sulfur dust in the stratosphere. But there are lots of other geoengineering ideas, like making clouds brighter by spraying seawater particles into the air. Social scientist Suzanne Moser says even the simplest ideas aren't simple at all.
I don't think that there is a quick and easy answer to employing even one of those quick and cheap and easy solutions.
There's no mechanism in place to reach a global consensus about doing this, and a consensus seems unlikely in any event. Who gets to decide where to set the global thermostat? And will this simply become an excuse not to control our emissions to begin with? These were all questions without answers at the Academy's meeting. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This is the summer when President Obama and much of Congress want to alter almost every part of our economy. The president is pushing health care changes, of course, and that's not the only huge item. A Democratic energy plan would affect everything from the light bulbs you buy to the source of the electricity that illuminates them. It would affect the kind of car you drive and the way your employer does business. All this summer, we'll be reporting on different parts of the plan before Congress. And this morning, NPR's Christopher Joyce is here to tell us what's at stake. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, so if you've got this bill, this energy bill, it's going to alter the whole economy. There must be a lot of lobbying over the details.
Very intense. I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen so many lobbyists from the energy industry on the Hill at one time. And it's not just the energy industry, because this affects everything, factories, cement, paper companies, and, of course, a huge contingent of environmentalists. And there's so much at stake here that everybody wants to get into the action.
So they're arguing over every line of a bill that's 1,000 pages. I print out the table of contents here. The table of contents
that probably runs to 50 pages right there.
It's more than 7 pages of contents.
It's a very heavy bill.
And, of course, it's changing as we go. But what's the central goal that lawmakers are aiming for?
Well, simply put, it's to curb global warming by reducing greenhouse gases that cause global warming. And to do that, you change the entire way we get energy gradually away from fossil fuels, coal and oil and natural gas that create greenhouse gases, and toward renewable energy. And you do it with this thing called cap and trade, which is you put a cap on the greenhouse gases. You give people permits to emit them that generally ratchet down. And then if you have extra permits, you can trade them. I mean, you can, and if you need one, you can buy one.
Well, let's talk about some ways that that concept is changing in the hands of lobbyists as they argue with, work with lawmakers here. The idea was to make companies buy a permit to pollute, which gives them an incentive to pollute less. How's that changing?
Well, initially it was they were have to buy all of them, and now they're only going to have to buy 15% of them, at least at the beginning, and they're going to get 85% free. And that's got environmentalists very upset, and others who think that that's just too much of a giveaway at the beginning. And there's also the allocation of these. I mean, when you give away 85% of them, who gets them? As it turns out, the utility industry is going to get 35% of them. They want more. The refineries are going to get a tiny bit of them. They
oil
want
refineries.
More oil refineries. So everybody wants as many as they can get, and there's a lot of fighting going on about that.
Okay, so environmentalists are already unhappy that they think that they've given away too much here. But let's talk about another change. The plan was to force utilities to get a certain amount of electricity from renewable sources like wind and solar. How is that changing?
That number's come down. Initially, it was going to be 25%, and then it was 20, and now it's 15. But the people who want to see the economy move fast toward renewable energy say that this is just simply not enough to push change.
So environmentalists are not happy with the way that this bill is evolving. What about some of the industries that are pushing for changes that say changes are needed, like the coal and oil industries? Are they happy?
Well, they see the writing on the wall. The coal industry and oil industry know now that they can't fight this, that there is going to be a law. And I think what they're basically saying is, give us something that's not going to put us out of business. Give us something where there's a wiggle room and make it a slow burn so that we can have time to develop new technologies. If you're a cynic, you could also say what they're doing is stalling. That's the friction that's going on right now, how much leeway to give companies to adapt, and they want more time, and environmentalists tend to want less.
I can already hear the argument of defenders of this bill. They don't want to damage the economy. They also want to pass a bill and do what's practical and make sure they can get past that immense lobbying effort you're talking about. But are we reaching a point where environmentalists might say, look, this bill does nothing, we'll walk away from it?
That's a possibility. That's happened in the past. And so it's a matter of whether the perfect is going to be the enemy of the good in this, and whether there's going to be something that both sides can agree on.
One other thing I want to ask about Chris Joyce as we move forward here. Isn't this bill in some way, whatever they call it, however they structure it, going to need to force us as individuals, as companies, as a country, to just pay more for energy so that we're forced to use it more efficiently?
People don't like to admit that, but frankly, people want their cake and eat it too, and the fact is, you can't.
NPR's Christopher Joyce is one of our correspondents. We'll be covering the lobbying over the energy bill in the next few months. Chris, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And we'll be listening for you again.
This next story is about something very pleasant, tickling babies. Once an infant is a few months old, you hear something like this if you go kitchy-kitchy-coo. But if the baby being tickled is a gorilla or a chimpanzee, you'll hear something a little different. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports on some new research into the origins of laughter.
Marina Davila Ross is a researcher at the University of Portsmouth in the United Kingdom. She recently went around to zoos in Europe and recorded the sounds that apes made as they were tickled by their caretakers. One of her videos shows a man tickling the big feet of a hairy gorilla. The gorilla makes these rumbling, breathy sounds and squirms around. It looks like he's cracking up and loving it.
That was absolutely fascinating. Yeah, how the relationship was between caretakers and the apes, and how they responded to the caretakers when they were tickled.
She didn't just record gorillas. She recorded bonobos being tickled, orangutans, and chimps. All of these great apes share a common ancestor with humans. But are their tickle-induced sounds really related to this?
Now, how can one really know that this is laughter?
To try to find out, Davila Ross took her recordings to the lab of Michael Overin of Georgia State University, who has studied the acoustics of human laughter. He says humans tend to go ha-ha-ha, while chimps' so-called laughter is more like panting. Almost like they're just exerting themselves.
I was reluctant to think of the chimpanzee pant-like vocalizations as being laughter. And I did not necessarily believe that there was a common origin between those sounds and human laughter.
But then the researchers analyzed various acoustic features in the recordings of tickled apes. Things like how many sounds were made in a burst, whether sounds were made on the exhale or the inhale or both, and how the vocal cords vibrated. And here's what they found. Overin says there's a revealing pattern of similarities and differences between these five related species. He says it seems likely that the origins of laughter go back at least to their last common ancestor, 10 to 16 million years ago. That ancestor had a primordial laughter-like sound, and specific features of this sound then got exaggerated or changed over evolutionary time as different apes emerged.
All these sounds do seem to have a common origin, evolutionarily speaking, and I am now comfortable calling them all laughter.
All of them?
All of them.
He says this raises a question. If these sounds are all laughter, what made humans develop our distinctive ha-ha-ha instead of something more like the panting of a chimp?
If human laughter has evolved in a somewhat different direction, then why did it do that? And why these features in particular?
He says understanding that could help us learn more about the function of human laughter. After all, we don't just laugh when we're tickled. The results are reported in the journal Current Biology. Robert Provine is a neuroscientist at the University of Maryland who studies laughter. He thinks the roots of laughter might go even further back. He'd like to see more studies like this one that compare different animals' playful sounds.
I think that it's about time we get out there, start tickling the dogs and the cats and the pigs, the rats, as well as the chimpanzees. I think we'll learn a lot about what we have in common, as well as our differences.
He says dogs pant in a certain way when they're having fun, and rats chirp, but lots of other animals haven't been studied.
What about whales? You know, do whales have some form of laughter? People really haven't looked into this.
In general, he says, laughter hasn't gotten a lot of attention from scientists. He says it's such an everyday thing that it basically goes unnoticed. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.